For a few years now, one of the pleasures we've had on this program is doing what we've called exit interviews. Though, of course, there's a bittersweet aspect to that, because the people who have exited to move on to other positions and opportunities have been people who've made tremendous contributions to Chicago music and the arts and those things together and around the world, but based here. And our latest exiter is Deborah Rutter, who has been with various titles, but the president and the CEO and the person guiding and keeping the ship moving at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association for almost 11 years now, started in August of 2003, is moving on to head the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And I think one of the things we'll talk about is why that's a move that she feels comfortable making, because we know of her great affection for this orchestra and its music directors and the city that has become home for her. So we're going to talk with Deborah about music, and we're going to talk with her about her career, particularly in Chicago, but also about the lessons she's gained from that and how now that she will be in Washington and to a great extent have an opportunity for a national platform to talk about the arts and arts education and how we value or don't value or need to value music and other arts in our lives, families, and schools. We'll be talking about that too. Deborah, welcome back to WFMT.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't believe that there's going to be a post-Deborah CSO. It just seems your time here has seemed so natural, even from when you arrived.
I have loved being here, and I'm sort of a fatalist. I believe that things happen for a reason. And while I didn't know the city very well, I certainly knew the music of this orchestra. I knew its history. I have lots of family, small connections. My husband is a musician because of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Mm-hmm. So it has felt truly like a blessing. And it's hard for me also to imagine not being here any longer. But when you have an opportunity to take what you've learned and take it to another level, you have to reach, stretch, and accept that opportunity.
Sure. And just as you did when you came to this orchestra, because you had been just before that in Seattle running a major orchestra there, you had just built a hall. That's not a small thing. And as you know from working with a hall that has gone through all kinds of changes during its 100-year-plus history, that's not an opportunity that comes along every day. And now you're going to a place where there are questions about expansion and new art center, and we'll come to that. How did it come about that the Kennedy Center opportunity came up? Were you headhunted? Did you answer an ad in the back of the playbill at the concert?
Well, our world is very connected. One of the great things about the electronic capacity that we all have is that we all know what's going on the instant it has happened, if not just before it has happened. And so I was aware that they had started a search. And there was an executive search firm that I spoke with and got to know the people there. I have known the city a little bit, perhaps a little bit more than I knew Chicago, in fact, before I got here. And I have colleagues there that I know very well. I haven't known the interconnectedness of all of the institutions there, and I didn't know how the place worked. And candidly, I'm still learning that along the way. So it was about getting to know the people there and seeing what the potential was. It all happened, over just about a year ago it started. There's a process that you go through.
What are the budgets of the CSOA and the Kennedy Center, and what are the constituent elements currently at the Kennedy Center?
Just to remind everybody, the Chicago Symphony is 123 years old. Budget is about $75 million. And we have our orchestra series, and we have our presentation series, which I'm very proud of as well. Symphony Center Presents, our chorus, which is fantastic, and the Institute for Learning, Access, and Training, which runs all of our education programs.
Including the Civic Orchestra.
Including the Civic Orchestra, which is a centerpiece of that aspect of our organization. The Kennedy Center is a budget just under $200 million. There are seven theaters under that one big roof. There are 2,000 performances. Most of those are ones that the Kennedy Center itself presents or produces. And there are, of course, some that are outside organizations that rent the spaces. There are resident affiliate groups, the National Symphony Orchestra, the Washington National Opera. Suzanne Farrell has a ballet company, mm-hmm. and they have a residency each year and an education program. And the education programs of the Kennedy Center are both local with all of those organizations and national. So those are pretty significant aspect of it. We have a chamber music series, a very active chamber music series. Jason Moran is the artistic director of a jazz series. We do 70 jazz concerts there each year. There are international festivals each year focusing on either themes or countries or continents, musical theater. And 365 days a year, there's a free program on the Millennium Stage at 6 o'clock. So it's a pretty extensive programming.
So are you just going to move a cot into your office? or is there a helicopter that can take you back and forth?
Well, I've always had the philosophy that you had to be really, really close to the hall. And I will probably still call it the hall, even though I think they call it the center.
Right.
So that you can go home for dinner and see your family and get back, or go to and from easily on a weekend. There are lots and lots of things. But the great opportunity for me, I think, is that I get to participate in all of the performing arts. And while I will have oversight vis-a-vis our relationship to the opera and the orchestra and the ballet and the contemporary dance and all of that, I won't have the day-to-day responsibility, so I will be able to sample, a buffet, of all of the different kind of programming, which will be really fun.
Right. And that's also, we'll come back to some of those elements, but it's also, I think, important to emphasize, as we've tried to do in our coverage from the beginning, of the announcement that you're going to be making this move, it's not as if you're leaving the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to go run another orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not saying, well, I'm through with this orchestra and I really have always wanted to run the Ratu Finnish Radio Orchestra. Although, who knows? Maybe it could be a nice
someday.
Thing 10 or 15 years from now, just quiet it down a bit.
Exactly.
So you came to Chicago at an interesting time. I mean, it's an interesting time probably for an administrator to go to almost any organization. But it was a time where there were a lot of shifts going on in society. There were a lot of shifts going on in Chicago. There was a brilliant but controversial music director. The orchestra was very, and you don't need to agree with my characterizations. I'm saying I don't want the listener to think I'm putting words in your mouth, but the orchestra was very divided. That might even have been a part of Mr. Barenboim's strategy artistically. Some people think he likes to create conflict to create the music he wants to make. It was a time, again, internationally, nationally, and locally, where there wasn't recording going on. Broadcasts were up in the air. At the same time, there was still that great reservoir of goodwill that the trustees, the donors, the subscribers, and the city as a whole, perhaps in part because the orchestra is right downtown, right across from the Art Institute, right on Michigan Avenue. But still, you came into both a wonderful opportunity and one where there were a lot of questions. And you're leaving now at a time when everybody wants to be the Chicago Symphony Orchestra when you look at the rest of the country in terms of, quote, labor peace, in terms of having a charismatic, popular, and extremely talented music director, making your own recordings, being back on the radio, discussing other media opportunities. And it's generally, I mean, every place has issues working, but for those of us who work with you all, it's a place where people are there because they love their jobs. There's very, very little turnover. People are not running in and out of the door there. So tell us a bit about how things went from A to B.
I think you're really right, Andrew, that the fundamental, which is the most important aspect of this institution, is that at the center we have a really extraordinary orchestra. And yes, some of the players come and go, and some of the most important players come and go. That will happen just because of the natural evolution of people's lives and how they develop and nurture and retirement and natural life decisions. But at the fundamental center is this great orchestra, and that's what we build from. I really have a strong belief that an orchestra has to be involved and engaged and committed and have a dynamic relationship with its city and its audiences. And our goal was to rebuild that as much as possible. And we've done it in a lot of different ways, starting from sort of the unseen but most felt aspect of customer service and a connection to our audience and thinking about what our audience wants to do, when they want to do it, how they want to get information, how we communicate with them, that we value them as a part of the concert experience, because it's not really a concert if there's no audience there, right? So it's really about a relationship with audience. And if you think about our work from the perspective of audience, you think about programming. And so over this period of time, we've diversified our offerings so that we have added new concert series, different days of week, different times of day, different format. Beyond the Score is one of the shining achievements, I think, of the last decade that I'm really proud of. It's about remembering that while this is an art form that has lasted for centuries and needs to last into the next centuries, that we have to connect the way in which we provide the program offerings in a way that is current with the way audiences are receiving information and participating today. So, for instance, there are not very many people who've bought new CDs recently. Right. Many of them, you know, still a whole lot of them have purchased our CDs, but digital downloads are much more important. And so for us to have the multi-track of understanding that some of our audience wants a CD and some of our audience only wants or needs or will retrieve music via electronic devices. So we approached a business venture in that way. We know that radio is still really important, mm-hmm. and it's important in a variety of ways. Some of it is because people are listening while they're at home, in the office, in the car, and some are listening online. So radio, we almost should have a different word for radio because radio sounds like you have to have a dial somewhere, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But in fact, radio is even more important online because people around the world are listening to us online through the broadcasts that we have.
And some of them are listening, to use the current terminology, live and by appointment, that is when it's scheduled, and some of them are listening on demand at times that you make available via CSO radio.
Exactly. And it's also really important, though, to know that this is a living art form, mm-hmm. and that while the Chicago Symphony Orchestra identity has evolved over these 123 years, and certainly with the current roster of performers on the, you know, musicians in the orchestra and the current musical leadership in Riccardo Muti, it has evolved again. It's really important for the world to know what this orchestra sounds like and not just revel in what, you know, the Schulte recordings or the Reiner recordings were, because that's not the orchestra of today. So that's why it's really important for us to keep the current orchestra out in the world today. So that's where radio, the recordings, and our website, Sounds and Stories, which is an aspect of our website where you can hear bits and pieces, and the webcast have been really important to us.
And touring.
And touring most of all. But even with touring, you can't get to Idaho. And there's a fantastic story. I received an email maybe a month ago, so long after the webcast of the Verdi in last October.
This was the Verdi Requiem.
The Verdi Requiem.
It was done in Grant Park.
It was
done at Orchestra Hall.
Exactly.
But it was also screened live at Millennium Park at the Pritzker Pavilion for thousands of people.
Right. And
Benito, around the world.
And Benito Juarez Academy.
And Benito Juarez Academy in Pilsen.
And I received an email from a woman in Idaho who wrote and shared her story that her father had recently passed away, and that she had had a troubled relationship at the end of his life with him, but that in grieving him, she needed to have a way to think about him and reflect on him, and she knew that he loved the Verdi Requiem. So she went online and typed in Verdi Requiem and popped up the Chicago Symphony Orchestra's webcast. Mm. And she said that her experience of this piece that she did not know well had changed her life.
Wow.
And, you know, when you read an email of thanks like that, you understand the power of music, the importance of what we do, and the importance of sharing it in this way, because you can never guess of that experience for that woman.
Right.
And to know that we've gotten more than 200,000 listeners or viewers of that already is really important. To me, think of how many more stories like that one that we have from that. So it's really important to use what we have available to get the word out about what our orchestra does. Thank you.
Pacis me, non sunt digne, sed tu bonus fac benigne, nebere ni cremeri.
There's a famous story I've told before, and I want to tell it briefly again because it does tie in, but also takes us to some other related points. The journalist Murray Kempton told this story about how, as a young journalist, one of his first assignments was to go and interview Bert Lahr. And Bert Lahr had been the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, but he also was a great stage actor. In fact, he introduced Waiting for Godot to the United States, though he said from the beginning to the end he never knew what the play was about. But he was one of the great performers, from burlesque to vaudeville to Broadway to film. And Kempton, who was a very articulate man, goes to interview him in his dressing room, whatever show he's doing, and he says, I just became tongue-tied, and I just asked the stupidest question. I said, Mr. Lahr, how do you do it? How do you go on night after night? And rather than Lahr saying, what a dumb question, go away, he said, well, you know, I was doing a show, blah, blah, and it was fine. And the houseman came by and knocked on my door. I was under the weather, and I had said, no visitors tonight. Tell him to come in a week. And he said, there's a man who wants to see you. And I said, no, I'm not seeing anybody. He said, he's soaking wet from head to toe. Said, he's soaking wet from head to toe. All right, I'll at least see what's going on. He opened the door and the man comes in. He says, Mister, you don't know me and I don't know you. And I don't know what this play was about. I didn't know anything about it. I was thrown out of my house by my wife. We've been fighting. I was walking down the street. It started to pour. I went under this portico. I saw the poster. It was intermission. People are walking in. I walked in. I found a seat. And your performance, your part, that's my life. And Lahr paused and said, and that's why you do it. He says, it's the person who's come in from out of the rain. You didn't know him. It's not the critic. It's not the subscriber. It's the person in Idaho who went on an internet search to try to figure things out between her and her dying father. And those are the things that you add all of those up and you get the motivation and you get the purpose, don't you?
That's exactly right. And that's why we do this.
Yeah.
Because we don't, those of us who work behind the scenes don't do it for the reward. I know what it's like to sit on the stage amongst an orchestra and feel what it's like. And it's an extraordinary feeling, let me just say.
Because you were second only to Heifetz, right?
Yeah, that's me. That's exactly right.
But you did play the violin and you played in school orchestras,
well,
right?
Or not? I also, one of the most important influences was the fact that I was in the American Youth Symphony, and Meili Mehta,
right,
who is Zubin and Zarin's father, was my violin teacher, and he was also the conductor of the orchestra.
And this is one of the founding youth. Now everybody has a youth orchestra. Every conductor has five youth orchestras everywhere. But Meili Mehta really created the sort of semi-professional youth orchestra movement.
Exactly. So. And it was the way in which he spoke
this
to us.
This was in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And it was while I was in high school. And I never thought of myself as a particularly great violin, but I just loved it. I loved sitting in and around, having the music around me.
You were saying the way he spoke to you all.
Yeah, the way he, what his expectations were. Mm. So it goes to laying out the demands of what it takes to make great art, what he knew it would take if any of us would go on to become professionals, and many of my colleagues in that orchestra did.
Mm-hmm.
John Broussier of our orchestra,
right,
was a colleague from that time. And yet you knew that he had your well-being at heart. This was not him trying to be a conductor and, oh, well, I haven't been able to conduct this piece yet, and this is my only way to have an opportunity to be able to conduct this piece. He was there as a mentor, as a teacher, helping us develop as young professionals.
Mm-hmm.
We started this line of conversation by my saying, I know what it's like to be on the stage, not with Riccardo Muti and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It's a different level of pressure, but I do know the joy that you get from being a player.
Right.
Those of us who work with orchestras don't get that piece of it, but we are affirmed because we are the ones who speak to the audience, hear from the audience, engage at the front of the house with the people who are being affected by the music, and that is the motivation that carries us from day to day.
We're speaking with Deborah Rutter. She is the outgoing president of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association, and it will have been almost exactly 11 years when she leaves us for Washington, D.C. and the Kennedy Center. Talking about Meili Mehta and your experience in the American Youth Symphony Orchestra is a good line into one of the main areas of your leadership at the orchestra and the association, and that was the need to find musical leadership long term, and your understanding of how important it was not only who's waving the baton and running the rehearsals, but who is inspiring the musicians, speaking to them, with them, and sometimes for them. And I was very fortunate, as listeners know, I try to go on as many of the tours with the orchestra as I can, and to make it clear to those of you who we thank for supporting WFMT, I do this with other funding, often out of my own pocket. I stay in friends' homes on their sofas. I wish I could stay in the hotels that the orchestra stays in, but they've earned it. They need to get up and play. So, one of the reasons I do that is to see how the organism works, the mechanism works. And on those first tours, I also had a very special opportunity, which was to sit on a number of the trains and buses with Deborah, because as a new person, even though you were quote-unquote the boss, you walked into a situation where the players, they did not really speak to the boss at that point, unless it was a formal setting. And we talked about your ideas for initiating regular conversations with the players' committee and the individual players, not only every few years when a contract was being negotiated. And we talked about your dream lists, mm-hmm, for this would have been a year or so later, but after Mr. Barenboim gave a 1 year's notice. And my recollection is that you said to me, and we were at that time speaking off the record, I think, but you said to me you wanted to keep the relationship with Pierre Boulez, which Mr. Barenboim had initiated, but which had become an independent relationship. You felt that was very necessary in general and during the transition. You would love to see if Bernard Haitink could come back to Chicago, and maybe there even could be a transitional post for him. And you were looking out the window of this bus, and you said, wouldn't it be something if we could get Ricardo Muti to come and conduct in Chicago and see what might happen? And you said all those things, and you made them happen with colleagues, with other people.
Yeah.
Tell us about all of that, and you must look back on all of this with legitimate pride and some happiness.
Well, you're very nice to say all of those things, Andrew. Thank you. You've raised a whole bunch of points. Let me start with the orchestra, if I may. My first job at the Los Angeles Philharmonic was as orchestra manager. And my big boss there, Ernest Fleischman, paid me the greatest compliment one day when he introduced me to the board of the LA Philharmonic after I'd been there a little while and said, this woman knows the orchestra because she spends time with them. She talks to them. She has a sense of the pulse of what's happening within the orchestra. Mm. And I didn't know that.
And Ernst was not a wonderful, brilliant man, but he was not known for throwing compliments around. Shall we put it that way?
That's for sure. I had more moments of tears in his presence than joy. But I had never thought that that's what I was doing. This was just what I understood to be important. You know, you need to create an environment for musicians to excel and for them to be able to talk about what their needs and their issues and their concerns and their joys are. And it's something I enjoy doing. As I said, I'm married to a musician. I've always had close friends as musicians. And so for me to establish opportunities to be with the players was really important, to hear directly from them. So we started formally and informal ways of doing that. And they have morphed into sort of traditions, habits.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, every time I walk into the basement, I like walking up and down the hallway just to get a sense of what's going on, hanging around, seeing who has what to say, checking in with the personnel manager, John Deverman, and say, tell me what's going on. Tell me what they think about what's going on stage. That's really exciting and important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that continues into the future because
right.
That's a way that we communicate formally and informally, both with the players committee and then with the orchestra as a whole. Whenever we have negotiations, there are always different perspectives. But what I am most proud of is the fact that we understand the language that we've been using. It doesn't change when
right.
we're sitting at the table than when we're sitting backstage or standing talking in the hallway or having another form of meetings.
And we'll come later in the conversation to some contrasting situations, but we do need to remind people at this point that there certainly have been and continue to be some high-profile examples of orchestras and managements where the language has disappeared or they're not even speaking past each other. They're speaking from different planets, and that's something that to both have that conversation as an ongoing thing and then even when there are differences to at least understand what the terms are when you're speaking together in a negotiation situation and stances is important.
Well, I think it's also important to have shared values. And it's my job, it's the job of this person who plays this role and the team that interacts most with the orchestra to bridge, heal, support, facilitate understanding between all the parties
mm-hmm.
and making sure that there are shared values. If you go back to the very formation of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, those men, they were men at that time, said, we want to have the greatest orchestra we can have, and we're going to do what it takes. And I'm telling you, that's how our board feels today.
Right.
Now, they are also very savvy business people who have kept us from all kinds of issues and launched us into many good policies, financial policies, other sort of business type of decisions. But if you ever let the balance between understanding the needs of the center, which is the orchestra, and the orchestra board, then you can getting out of balance is problematic. So it's our job to keep that communication open. There are always ups and downs. There are always times when the cycle is off. Nothing is ever permanent and permanently good or permanently bad, mm-hmm. but it takes constant work, as it does with any relationship. But I think that's something that everybody here has to remember, in fact. You mentioned the conductors and what we should do. I believe that keeping the orchestra central, as I have said, is critical. And therefore, finding a music director that is inspiring is going to help them learn and teach and grow. While that individual may have those experiences in different ways as well, is really important. So knowing who your orchestra is in a very, very deep way and what their needs are is really important, because then you can add in what's the relationship to community, what's the relationship to audience and programming. When you have an individual like Pierre Boulez, who is a giant of a man, a giant of a thinker, an artist, a creator, a composer, and such a generous human being, you have to have him as close as you possibly can. And so it was paramount to me that we sustain that relationship. And in his generosity, he agreed to stay. But thinking then about what the orchestra needed in a transition period, what kind of healing they might need for their own work together and for the divisiveness that you described pretty accurately, and then taking the orchestra and following on the greatness of what Daniel Barenboim brought to Chicago, the flexibility and the beauty of the sound, the right. fact that they could play anything, all of that came from Daniel Barenboim.
And the restoration of the strings as a part of an orchestra.
The strings, the building of the woodwind section,
right.
all of those things yeah. that Daniel Barenboim did. So he brought it to this level.
Right.
How do you grow from there?
Right.
Who could take it from there?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very few people in the world. You have to have the chemistry with the orchestra and then the capacity to help build the orchestra, because it's not a static organism. An orchestra is constantly changing, and you needed to have somebody who would understand it and be able to take it to the next level.
Related to all of that, too, is a demand for excellence and quality and profile as well. It doesn't mean that an orchestra manager doesn't take risks at times and take chances. We wouldn't have had any number of music directors for this orchestra if there people forget what George Schulte's profile was when John Edwards recruited him to be. He was an opera conductor who made records. That was sort
exactly.
of his,
exactly.
and it was a fine one, but there was no track record for various reasons there. There are other chances that can be taken. At the same time, though, there sort of has reemerged this idea that Chicago is going to take that leadership position very seriously and want somebody of international standing, not only in the past, but in terms of what he or she is doing now.
Well, I think we're in an interesting time with conductors. There are a lot of interesting young conductors now who are still learning repertoire, who are still deepening their relationship with that repertoire. And there are quite a number of conductors of an older generation. And there are some really extraordinary in between ages, but not lots of them.
Right, right.
And they are doing some really fine work with orchestras. But there is an interesting gap of the legacy of conductors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as we look to those who are 40 and younger, we will see quite a richness for the future.
Right.
Quite a richness for the future. But in that in-between area, there are really not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about relationship and chemistry and availability and the very intangible but important quality of relationship to repertoire and ability to communicate that, and then to have the gravitas in a place like Chicago, where the orchestra and the audiences alike expect a pretty high profile and pretty high level of intellectual stimulation through the music. And Riccardo Muti has an amazing capacity to speak about music, speak about the ephemeral aspect of what music can do to an individual and their soul, to speak in detail about the history and the language and how this music has come forward, and to be able to communicate that to the orchestra. He and Bernard Haitink couldn't be more different in that
right,
way,
right.
In that Bernard Haitink could also do it, but he used very few words, but he did it through his physical gesture, his eyes, mm-hmm. the subtlety of the things that he asked for, and, as they say, the stick. Mm-hmm. Riccardo Muti does it with a very personable approach on the stage, and he is almost a full-time educator, both for the orchestra and when we have open rehearsals for the audience
and
as well.
And entertainer, too.
Well, I mean, I'll let you say that.
Sense.
Yes, okay. Exactly. No, absolutely. That's what right. has been the magnetism that has drawn people
right.
In.
The other thing that's so important with those men, and of course with Muti as the music director, is an understanding and attention to nuts and bolts as well. In the words of Nicholas Harnoncourt on this program some years ago, no names, no names. Mm-hmm. But we all know there are some very fine conductors out there who, as music directors, did or don't pay a lot of attention to auditions, to recruitment, to training within the orchestra. A very prominent conductor, outstanding conductor, recently was music director of an orchestra, and in his contract, it said he would not participate in auditions. So that is not how it is here
right.
With Boulez, and then Barenboim, Boulez, and now Muti.
And Haitink as well,
who didn't want to initially, but saw how important it was and had the experience.
Exactly. And he was very connected to the musicians. He was very concerned about who was coming into the orchestra, then welcoming them, nurturing
right.
them, talking with those players who had issues. He was great about it, too.
Right.
But Muti has really dedicated enormous energy to that. And look at the extraordinary players who have joined the orchestra
right.
in the last 5 years.
Right. No, the auditions and the willingness, even though sometimes the audience might be impatient, but to wait until the right person comes along.
Oh,
not
exactly.
just to say, let's fill this job and have this person here for 35 years
right.
and say, well, that was because we had to fill that job.
So. Right. Well, I give a lot of credit to the players for that as well. This is a history of auditions. I remember when I first got here, we had an opening in the horn section, and legend has it that it took 8 years to fill the equivalent of a utility horn position. And the woman who has that job is extraordinary.
Right.
So we waited for the right person, and, she has transformed the orchestra in her way as well.
Waiting for the right people, finding people who effect transformation as well as inspiring and directing transformations herself. All of these are a part of what Deborah Rutter has brought to Chicago and to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association and the CSO itself. And we are finishing up part one of our two-part exit interview as Deborah prepares to move to our nation's capital where everybody gets along and politics never enter into anything. We'll reach all of that when we talk about the Kennedy Center and more about Chicago next week.
Thank you. Deborah Rutter graciously made our music selections for both this week and next. We open tonight with the prelude from the first Bach cello suite in G major, BWV 1007, with Yo-Yo Ma. Midway, we heard from the Dies Irae sequence of the Verdi Requiem, the Ingemisco, tenor Mario Zeffiri, Riccardo Muti conducting the CSO and CSO chorus, recorded for CSO Resound in 2009. And we closed with, from the first CSO Resound release, Bernard Haitink conducting the orchestra with mezzo Michel de Jong in the fourth movement of Mahler's Third Symphony, marked sehr langsam and mysterioso. It was recorded at Orchestra Hall in 2006. We'd like to thank Deborah Rutter and Rochelle Rowe for helping to arrange this conversation, our funder, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of the program. Drop us a line to RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or go to WFMT.com/criticalthinking where you can hear this or any of these programs again anytime. For Andrew Patner, I'm Matt DiStefano. I post-produce these programs. And join us again next Monday for the conclusion of this two-part conversation with Deborah Rutter. That's all right here on Critical Thinking.